What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Point, but I'd like to span this out of the financial services because I saw it through the lens of non-financial U.S. public companies, where if one individual has a large amount of GTE spend, has a large amount of marketing spend, has directed a large amounts of charitable donation where they had never done before, that is a type of anomaly that should be explored, should be investigated. Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox, and I'd like to welcome you to the award-winning Compliance Into the Weeds, where together with my co-host, Matt Kelly, we take a deep dive into a compliance or compliance-related topic each week. This week, we turn to current events and the sporting and gambling world to look at the scandal with Jonte Porter in the NBA and betting on him, how that led to his lifetime suspension and lessons for the compliance professional from this tale. First, we're going to have a word from our sponsor, Ethoco.
And accessibility is a daunting task. Ethoco makes it effortless with real-time permissions control. This feature ensures that sensitive information is both secure and accessible while balancing confidentiality with efficiency. It's about creating a fortress around your data while keeping the gates flexible for those who need access. Discover a solution where security meets agility. Step into a world of controlled freedom with Ethoco. Learn about reshaping your data security at ethoco.com/CPN. Book a demo, download our white paper by Tom Fox, The ROI of Compliance, and try our free ROI calculator to start a new chapter in ethics and compliance management.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox back again with Matt Kelly for another episode of the award-winning Compliance Into the Weeds. Welcome back, Matt.
Hello, Tom. Always good to be here.
Matt, today I wanted to take up a case of Jonte Porter, who unfortunately was handed down a lifetime suspension from playing in the NBA. I found this story both sad and tragic, but I thought it had a lot of lessons for the compliance professional. ESPN reported that betting sites grew suspicious when large amounts of money were made on prop bets for Porter back in January. He plays for the, or played for, the Toronto Raptors, and he was a very much a bench bit player. In the game of January 26th against the LA Clippers, there was an increase in betting amounts for Porter props for the night, which were set at the following: 5.5 total points over under, 4.5 total rebounds over under, and 1.5 assists. There was also an over under for the number of 3-point shots he would make, which was set at 0.5, which tells you he wasn't going to play very much. There was a large detection or a detection of large amounts of betting interest on him by U.S. sportsbooks, and one sportsbook industry expert told ESPN that multiple bets in the range of $10,000 to $20,000 were put on Porter on the unders for that game. Typically, a prop bet for an NBA player can vary, but they're typically $1,000 to $2,000. All of the unders won on January 26th. But there was a second game in March where the over-under was for Porter to play 5 minutes, and he played just 4 minutes before leaving the game with an alleged aggravation of an eye injury, which no one saw him be aggravatedly injured. He had 3 rebounds and 1 assist, and he went under on all the props. There was one $80,000 bet for him on the under, and he is 3-pointers for that night, was the biggest money winner on all NBA game prop bets. So that was the two instances. After the first one, that raised suspicions, and the league investigated. And then last week, Adam Silver came down with the penalty of, or consequence of, a lifetime suspension. What intrigued me, Matt, was the use of data, the use of data to show the anomalous bets made on Porter, the use of data to show the large amount of bets made on Porter, the use of data to show that Porter, while certainly a bench player or one who would not typically influence a game, yet because of the anomalies, it put the game at risk. And then the investigation and consequence, which we would probably call consequence management. So with all of that, did you see any lessons from the compliance professional in the Jonte Porter case?
Well, I did. This is a fascinating case. And Tom, thank you for bringing it up, because I have to admit that gambling generally is not something I engage much in. So I hadn't really paid much attention to it. But when you really take a step back here, I think probably the two biggest points I see are, number one, the benefits of, and here's a buzzword we use in corporate America a lot, but it fits here, the benefits of digital transformation of a business or an industry. Because, you know, my first question is whether anybody would have noticed some sort of misconduct like this in 1975, when most of the bookies were still keeping their notes on actual paper books, and there was very little centralization the way that there is today. But it is more that by the sports betting world going digital, and sports world, aside from betting, you know, just about every single action in sports now is cataloged and indexed and is in a database somewhere, that creates the opportunity for the data to be analyzed to identify these anomalous events. So we can get into the data analytics later. But Tom, the other thing that you brought up that I think we should dwell on, with all due respect to Mr. Porter, who I'm sure is a better basketball player than me, he's not a great player. He's not Jaylen Brown at the Boston Celtics. And I'm pretty sure if Jaylen Brown were anywhere near trying to bet on games, everybody and their uncle would see it immediately. But do you also look at some of your minor bit players, like Jonte Porter, who is probably better than 99% of the people who play basketball, but he wasn't anything special in the NBA, and maybe that would let him fly under the radar if that is what he was thinking. But thanks to the data analytics out there, thanks to this system, this ecosystem that has been digitized, we could do the data analytics that would allow people to spot even a fairly anonymous, you know, journeyman sort of a player like Jonte Porter. He and his bets were identified. We can go from there, but, you know, I think those are the two big lessons right away. And we've got a bunch more we could spin up too.
Matt, there's another one that I thought of that I really had not considered in a long time. And this really, you may remember, in the first decade of this century, and in the first part of the second decade, there was a debate about whether facilitation payments should be allowed. And obviously the debate, or part of the debate, was, well, it's a bribe. Should we allow bribes, period? And the UK, under the Bribery Act, took the position they were going to outlaw facilitation payments. But one argument I heard here, really, as I said, in the first decade of this century, was, well, if you completely outlaw them, you drive them underground and we have zero visibility. And it struck me here, that's similar to what happened after the legalization of gambling, which was, we had much greater visibility, perhaps even further back than that, because, as you noted, sports books have become so ubiquitous in states that did have legalized gambling. They may have picked this up. But if we hadn't had legalized gambling, we might not have picked this up. We certainly would not have been such a big press story. And so I hadn't thought about facilitation payments in a long time, but I did think about, and the example of the CCO at the time, I remember him saying, by allowing them, we at least see what people are doing and what they're reporting. And if there's a problem, we can move to remediate, train, whatever we need to do, take care of it. If we completely outlaw them and no one reports them, then we may not ever find out, or we might find out too late. So that was really one of the areas that I thought about. And then the consequence management. Adam Silver was very decisive. I do believe there was an investigation. We don't have a copy of that, but it was reported there was an investigation. So I'm going to assume there was an investigation, so it wasn't a summary firing or lifetime suspension. But Silver had to send a message. This is the first large betting scandal since the NBA, or legalized gambling, has really taken hold across the country. And whether or not Silver had to make, or did make, an example out of Porter, I thought he had to. And I don't think there could have been anything less in terms of a consequence. And I know you talk about consequence management a fair amount, and I wanted to get maybe your take on, was it too much? Was it just right? What did Porter have to be made an example? This is not Pete Rose betting on baseball, but it's somebody betting on themselves, basically.
I mean, it's within the realm of Pete Rose betting on baseball. I think this is a perfectly fine consequence. I mean, what Mr. Porter was doing was really impugning the integrity of the game. And as people have always said before, if you allow something in one form, ultimately you risk allowing it in many forms. And then what? Are we going to have every single journeyman player in the NBA trying to bet on games here or there, especially as the nature of the bets has proliferated now? You have these prop bets, which I have to admit, I looked that up because I didn't know what a prop bet was. But for those who do not know, that is a bet you might make about game activity. Will somebody hit a certain number of three-pointers, or will they play a certain number of times? That bet is irrespective of, is the team actually going to win or not? A prop bet is something that happens in the game, irrelevant to whether the game is won in a certain way or not. There would be all sorts of ways that you could tarnish the integrity of the game. And so I think that the NBA had really no choice but to hand down what is a professional death penalty for Mr. Porter. You know, he's going to have this be his chief Google result for the rest of his life. I'm sorry that he got tarred with that, because it's going to be tough to shake. But what he did was a very serious thing. So, no, I think that this consequence was perfectly well warranted. It's also perfectly well executed, because every NBA player in the league is now going to see, this is what happens if I try this. And most of them make far more money than they ever will dabbling on sports bets. So shut up, play your game as best you can, win or lose, and you're still going to make many millions per year, which is more than most people. So take the win, so to speak, and you don't have to do that. But Tom, I would be curious to know how the NBA investigated this, because they did this so quickly. This first incident happened in January. It is April. It's what, less than 3 months? That is record time compared to, say, an FCPA investigation or other of the compliance scandals we usually write about in the corporate world. And how did they figure out that certain people who were betting were colleagues or acquaintances of Mr. Porter, that clearly there must have been some degree of collusion? And how did they figure out that this betting account here ties back to this person who is BFFs with Mr. Porter? And now, you know, the noose closes in. Like, I would love to know how that investigation worked, because it worked at astonishing speed.
So I think, Matt, it worked because of the data that was available.
Yep.
And it wasn't simply the numbers we saw, but the second game where he feigned or allegedly feigned an injury, a re-injuring of his eyes. They had video of him the whole game, and never once did he rub his eyes or rub his head in a way that would indicate, oh, I got poked in the eye, or, oh, something happened. And so there was, I don't want to say ongoing surveillance, but, you know, when you're on camera for your professional career, or at least the professional portion of when you're playing basketball, that's a lot of information.
Yeah.
And then some of the other forensics in terms of just phones down to the traditional form of interview, where he apparently admitted he had given that information about the eye injury to bettors before that game.
Well, actually, Tom, I don't think it is far-fetched to say that you are under continuous surveillance as an NBA player, because when I was looking at this story and thinking about what is the nearest analogy to the traditional compliance world, it would probably be anti-money laundering and suspicious transaction reporting and transaction monitoring generally, because these transactions do generate an awful lot of data. The entire financial services world has now essentially been digitally transformed. So there is data everywhere you look, but you do need that sophisticated analytics capability to be able to see, okay, this transaction is unusual because of who is involved, or it's unusual because of the size, but not the who, or it's unusual because of the frequency, but not the size or the who of what the transaction is. And that is something that you'd need to think about. You know, if we went back to the NBA example, it's not just enough to look at what is the actual bet, but is it a large bet relative to prior bets? Is it a bet that is more frequent or happening more frequently than usual? Are there unusual bettors involved, unusual betting patterns like these parlays, which is another one I had to look up. And for those of you who do not know it, it's when you bet on two different things happening within the same game, but they both have to happen. So there are bigger payoffs. But, you know, you need to have a really sophisticated understanding of what an outlier transaction would be. And that's very true in transaction monitoring and AML compliance. It is also true that the players in transaction and financial services, the day traders, they are under continuous surveillance pretty much. They do have their phones monitored and their voices recorded when they're doing deals and all this other stuff. And you have a rich vein of data to explore. And if there is an anomalous thing, then you, the financial firm, when your AML compliance picks up on this weird thing, you are supposed to file a suspicious activity report. And those are fairly clearly formatted by FinCEN, that's the regulator in charge of all this, where they have different fields that you are supposed to put in, and you can be sanctioned, you, the bank, if you're not filling in the information correctly, or if you have it, but then you leave some of it off. So they have that down to a science in anti-money laundering compliance. And it looks to me like the NBA has done a really good job here, because this was an obscure player with some obscure bets. And, you know, nonetheless, they managed to root it out fairly quickly and resolve this to their satisfaction within 3 months, which nothing happens in 3 months in corporate compliance, nothing at all, to my knowledge. And then there was the consequence management, which told the rest of the people in the enterprise known as the NBA, don't do this or else. And I think that message was delivered. So this really is an excellent example, I think, of compliance done well.
There was another data point that the bettors were located in a very distinct geographic area. So there was one more data point. But I'd like to span this out of the financial services, because I saw it through the lens of non-financial U.S. public companies, where if one individual has a large amount of GTE spend, has a large amount of marketing spend, has directed a large amounts of charitable donation where they had never done before, that is a type of anomaly that should be explored, should be investigated. You should at least ask a question. Why was that money used for the first time by this person here? And if it involves a state-owned enterprise or governmental agency, that is perhaps even a higher risk or an additional reason to do so. And so I hope that compliance professionals will take away what I saw as, because there was an anomaly, and in this case, several anomalies, it led to an investigation and a consequence. But what I want them to understand you use the data for is not to tell us there was an illegal bet or there was something askance, but that there was an anomaly. And just take another look at it. And you ticked off some great points, the how, the where, the why, the who. If any of those are unusual, that warrants an investigation, and that could be the power of data analytics. Well, Matt, unfortunately, we are near the end of our time for this episode, but it was certainly an interesting lesson for me. I got a lot out of it, and I look forward to seeing what we come up with next week. This is Tom Fox again. As I mentioned at the start of this podcast, our sponsor for the Compliance Podcast Network this month is Ethico. Have you ever struggled with the ROI of your compliance program? Have you struggled with how to present your compliance program budget request to your chief financial officer? Well, I paired with Ethico to help you in both of those. Ethico has created an ROI compliance calculator, and I've written a white paper on the ROI of compliance. You can get those by going to the website listed on the show notes. I hope you will check it out. I hope you will use it, and I hope you will let us know whether it helped you or not.
I'd like to tell you about the latest edition of the Compliance Podcast Network, the Compliance Tip of the Day, where in 3 to 5 minutes, I give you a quick compliance tip that you can use to integrate, upgrade, and enhance your compliance program. Check it out on the Compliance Podcast Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.